All right. Welcome to the Dad the Best I Can podcast. Today, we are lucky to be joined by Pat Flynn. Pat is a father, a husband, and an entrepreneur. He owns several online businesses, is a Wall Street Journal best-selling author, and you guys probably know him best from the Smart Passive Income podcast, which has over 60 million downloads. How's it going today, Pat?
It's going well. I'm excited to talk dad stuff. I don't get to talk about dad stuff a lot, so I'm stoked to be here.
Yes. Where are you calling in from?
I'm calling in from San Diego, California.
San Diego always sounds like the, if you could live anywhere in the United States, that's where to be. Would you agree with that?
Yes, which is why we're here, but I mean, it has its drawbacks. We definitely pay a weather tax over here for sure. But thankfully right now we're pretty safe from all the fires, but you know, and earthquakes are a thing here too. So it's not all, you know, unicorns and rainbows, but definitely my top place in the world for sure.
Yeah. And dad life is interesting these days. This week, I think I watched a YouTube video. Your kids, do they start school this week?
They started school this week. They are required to be in virtual school, virtual learning right now. Two kids, fifth grader, second grader, literally in the mornings at 9 when I go live on YouTube, they're live on Zoom with their class. And thankfully we have good bandwidth in the house or else we'd be screwed. But it's interesting to navigate, but I'm excited. I think they are adapting really well and they're learning how to, you know, even more so than at school, manage their own time. And I think that's really exciting. So I'm trying to always look at the bright side of things for sure.
Yeah, I saw you have awesome Instagram and your YouTube is just insane these days. So much good content. And you had this one clip that I totally related to. You're in your room and you hear the kids knocking on the door and it's like, you're all annoyed at first because of course they're interrupting. You're probably recording something. And then you come to the door and it's your two kids saying, I love you, Dad. And you're like, no, all right. I'm sorry. I was such a jerk. That's something we go through every day around here.
It's hard to balance, you know, because your work brain is different often than your parent brain, right? And sometimes we just get so inside our own bottle, it's hard to read the label from the outside sometimes. So we need other people. I'm very thankful I have my wife, April, here as well to tag team with the kids. And she takes care of them so well and allows me to have sort of an open mind when I'm going into work, and work being in my home office and live on my YouTube stream or in a podcast like this one, or you know, hunkering down for the next big launch or whatever. But the kids, they're here, the real thing. And I'm thankful because I often try to get them involved or at least understand why I'm in here, or when I go travel, why I'm traveling. I try to get them invested in why it's important for me to do what I do. Because when I was a kid, like my dad would work, he worked for the government. So he was gone a lot and he never told me what he was doing. He was just like, I'm leaving for work. So me, work was like associated with, okay, that means parent is gone. I'm trying to like flip the script and make work actually be able to bring us together. I bring the kids in the office. Sometimes they play around with the podcasting equipment. My son and I have a podcast together. My son and my family and I have been on trips to go to speaking events together, and just, I kind of get them involved as much as possible because, you know, we're a unit.
Yeah. And this is their reality is going to be like this. This is going to be working on computers all day. So they're really seeing their dad model it, which is a big head start, I imagine, compared to a lot of kids out there.
True. Yeah. I mean, I would say so. But at the same time, I also have to model properly showing them that we can't be in front of the screen the entire time, or we shouldn't be, that we can have fun outside of an iPad, right? Or Fortnite or whatever. At the same time, although I'm getting them involved with things that I'm doing, I want to be involved with the things that they are interested in. So my son and daughter both are pretty avid gamers. And we actually stream on Twitch 3 days a week together now because we're loving it so much. And I just, whatever the games they want to play, I get involved and I try to learn as much about it as possible. I got into a Minecraft bug a long time ago because of that. Now I'm in a Fortnite bug and, you know, I'm spending V-Bucks and stuff and trying to like, and I'm just kind of in it with them, which I think is really cool. So, you know, it's kind of a give and take back and forth. You know, hey, I'm doing this thing. You want to come and check it out? Cool. Well, what are you doing? Let me come and check it out and let's kind of work on it together.
Yeah, that's my son, 8-year-old, he is obsessed with Fortnite right now. And you hear a lot of my friends with older kids were saying, oh, we don't let him play it. Some do. So I'm kind of still like navigating it, but he loves it. And it is good to hear that responsible parents out there are cool with it. From what I gathered, it's kind of like a Hunger Games-esque thing, but he's really into it and he gets really excited about it. So I want to support him. I'm just like, you have 1 hour to play and then I must turn it off because you'll play for 6 hours if I don't.
I would recommend you try playing it with him. Number one, you're going to see how much skill he likely has as a result. and how poor we are at it. But I think at the same time, it's just, again, whatever it is that they want to do, like, do together, I think. And, you know, Fortnite, in my opinion, of all like the shooter games, is probably the friendliest and most, or least gruesome, if you will. There's other ones like Call of Duty and you know, Black Ops and stuff, which are like, that's, they're not ready for that yet. This one, people don't get killed, they get eliminated. I mean, there's just, anyway.
Right. Yeah, he showed me he was a like cat character, and I'm like, okay, I can't be that. You're not shooting people like Call of Duty. Like, it did feel, make me feel a little better. And it is to see his enthusiasm. I mean, it's hard to say stop playing this game, which is something maybe our parents' generation did more, and we just, it's just a different world now where we do have to be more receptive.
The interesting thing is when the conversation comes up, like, oh, I want to do Fortnite for a living, and I'm like, we need to talk about what you think for a living means and what all that entails. It's cool to hear people like Ninja and all these other people, Buja, who won $3 million in a Fortnite tournament. He's like 15 years old. And it's like, hey, that's possible. But there's also 80 billion or 80 million people who like play and play recreationally, and probably millions of people who play and forget to take care of their body, forget to eat, forget to go out and exercise, and forget about relationships. And there's a whole spectrum, right? So honest, real conversations have to happen every once in a while.
Yeah, and I think, like you said, the only way to really have those conversations is if you are kind of in there playing and learning what they're doing. And yes, I'm going to have to teach my son about a survivor bias, where you're only seeing Dan TDM is one of a billion people out there. So you can't just be a YouTube star. Actually, you'll enjoy this. I just started putting these up on YouTube, and he looked at it. He was excited at first. And he's like, Dad, you got 33 subscribers? Come on now. I was like, wow, I got my kid making fun of me because he's expecting a dude perfect level numbers out of the gate.
You know, we all start from zero, though. You know, it's not to say we can't ever get there.
Well, yeah, along those lines, I have to start with a story. 2 years ago, my family moved from Las Vegas to Atlanta area. I was a professional poker player there for 11 years, so I had a big life change, 3 kids under 6 at the time. And I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and obviously devouring podcasts and Joe Rogan, Tim Ferriss, Bill Simmons, all those I just loved. And you learn so much through the medium. Mm-hmm. Like everybody, I said, I want to start a podcast, right? And the biggest impetus to me starting it and publishing my first 3 episodes, which is a tip you tell everybody, was Pat Flynn. And now 90 something episodes later, I'm talking to Pat Flynn my other inspiration, Jesse Itzler, and on his BYLR radio station. So it's really crazy. I don't necessarily believe in the law of attraction kind of thing, but taking action, just putting yourself out there, being willing to screw up and making connections, it really does show. So I appreciate you. And you really are a role model for a lot of us, because you do make it relatable and accessible, and that's not something everybody does.
I appreciate you for that. Thank you. And I'm honored to be associated with Jesse in this way. I haven't met him yet, but he's definitely an inspiration. I follow his Instagram and all of his anti-Kellogg stuff. I'm very much supportive of, like, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, just congrats to you on your podcast and getting it going. I'm glad I played a little bit of a role in that, but you've taken it, you've done it, and that's all you, man. Congrats.
Yeah, that's the advice I tell anybody that's thinking about it. I said, put a deadline on it, or I say, Pat says, put a deadline on it and commit to 3 episodes. They could be with your neighbor, your dog, it doesn't matter, and just get them done and don't worry about how crappy they are, because they will be. I mean, even yours, you look at your episodes from how long ago, 10 years, and I'm sure they've come a long way.
They're terrible. You didn't even hear the ones that I didn't publish either, but you have to be a disaster before you become the master, and you can't be the master unless you start out that way. So congrats.
Good lesson for our kids too. So for those of us who are just getting to know Pat Flynn, can you tell us a little bit about your story, how you got into the podcast world, entrepreneur world?
Yeah, I definitely didn't plan on that when I was in school. When I was in school, I wanted to be an architect, and I went to UC Berkeley, got a degree in architecture, graduated magna cum laude. Like, architecture was my life. I got a great job in the Bay Area at this renowned firm building restaurants and even hotels in Vegas, in fact. And I was set, like, my whole life path was set for the next 40 years. I eventually wanted to own my own firm and all this stuff. Until July 17th, 2008, I got pulled into my boss's office. And you might remember the 2008s. This was when the last recession was sort of going down, and I went down with it. I got let go. And it was a tough time for me because I didn't really have a plan B. I dedicated my entire life and you know, 90 hours a week to this thing. I was studying it outside of work. I was taking seminars and taking exams I didn't even need to because I was just so engulfed in it. And then I still got let go, even though I was a top performer. And it really derailed me. And it took a number of weeks to get over that depression until I finally discovered that nothing was going to happen unless I got up and did something about it. And that's when I discovered podcasts. That was my discovery of podcasts. And there was one particular podcast called Internet Business Mastery, where I heard one episode. And this episode, I don't know how it got and landed on me, or it wasn't even the latest one that came out, but it was an interview with a guy named Cornelius Fitchner from, he was teaching people how to pass the project management exam online, or the PM exam. And I was like, whoa, you could teach people how to do like these little things. And he was like, yeah, I make six figures a year doing that. And I was like, what? Like, that's way more money than I make as an architect right now. And you do this online, and it kind of, you wake up in the morning and more sales of your courses, more sales of your quizzes like happen. And I just got so obsessed with like, how can I potentially make this work? Because I had just recently taken a number of exams, one in particular called the LEED exam, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, a very niche exam in the architecture space that was very difficult. And I said, you know what? This is on top of my mind right now. I'm getting inspired by this podcast. I'm going to build a resource to help people pass this exam. I'm also going to be very involved in getting into forums and just showing up and trying to paint myself the expert. I didn't know all the answers. I had barely even passed the exam, but I was going to be the person who could look up all the answers for everybody and who could be there to organize this information to better enable people to pass this exam. And so that's what I did. And within 3 months, people were recommending my website everywhere. And in fact, it was even linked to on United States Green Building Council websites because the information was so helpful to people. So then in late 2009, I published an ebook, a study guide, just essentially the same notes that I had on my website in a $19.99 ebook that people could download. It gets sent to them via email right away. And it didn't cost me anything to create other than time. And in that first month, I made $7,908.55. The next month, over $9,000. Then I added an audio guide to go along with it. I hired somebody to voice over the book for me. And then I made $14,000, $18,000. March of 2009, I made over $30,000 selling I increased the price, $29.99 ebook. And it completely changed my life, obviously. And it made me realize that more than just like more money, that I was getting more thank yous. I was getting more recognition for helping people in this way versus when I was working so hard as an architect. I have my fingerprint on so many buildings around this world, nobody will ever know. And here I was helping people pass this little tiny exam within a space, and yet people were sending me thank you notes, flowers because I helped them get a promotion, like all this stuff, calling me by name, even having fans. I was like, what? I have fans for helping you pass an exam? I don't get it. But then soon I realized people are looking for help. They are going to the internet to find that help. And if you could show up and you can be a real person that people can connect with and you build a relationship, you could truly change lives, and you don't need to change that many lives to have an incredibly successful business. So what happened then, I started a website called smartpassiveincome.com to teach people what I did and show people the ropes and what I learned, what I wish I'd done differently, continuing to share what I was making wrong moves about and sharing what I was making right moves about. And since then, I've built several different businesses publicly, showing people how to do it just live, and it inspires people. And now I have books and I speak on keynote stages around the world. I'm on awesome podcasts like this one. I get to connect with some amazing personalities that I never thought I would have had a chance to meet. In fact, it was my podcast that allowed me to connect with Tim Ferriss, because I started a podcast in 2010 because I always knew I wanted to start one because it was one that helped me. Eventually, I started one after a year and a half of trying because I was so scared, but eventually I got it up. And now 10 years later, over 65 million downloads, 5 podcasts, 1,600 episodes recorded, and thousands of students who have taken my courses and who've watched my free YouTube videos about podcasting. It's just incredible. And most of all, beyond the money, beyond the connections, beyond the quote unquote success, it's the flexibility that it's allowed me to have with my family. I now have built my business in a way, this is lifestyle design, creating my businesses in a way where I'm not managing things that require me to be there all the time. It's almost like a way to set things up so that they continue to work for me over time, and putting people into place to help me, or systems of automation, tools, so that I can, again, spend most of my time with my family and be here for every moment and support my wife and, you know, show them that they have the options to do something similar too. And whether they choose to be an entrepreneur or not, I don't care. I just want them to do what they think is right for them and show them all the options too.
Yeah, that is Tim Ferriss and lifestyle design. That was a very seductive thing. I read 4-Hour Workweek and I felt the same thing. Mm-hmm. And hearing you talk about it, I mean, for me, I always relate better to now as a parent. It resonates a lot more when I hear from parents that are out there doing it. And I know you probably had either no kids or very young kids at the start, but it does seem like a lot more accessible. So it's really cool to hear from people like you and from Jesse who are out there, you know, working their butt off, but doing it with kids at home and trying to set up their life so they can have this flexibility to be with their kids. So that's really cool. And I also find it was interesting what you're saying about, you know, 60 million downloads, podcasts, all these things. I watched, you know, preparing for this interview, I was watching a bunch of YouTube videos, your Instagram. It feels like you're talking to me. You know, you're looking in the camera, you are very relatable and you're very, you know, you can joke about yourself and things, which I think is very important as an entrepreneur and as a dad. You know, you have to make fun of yourself because you're going to screw up constantly. But I think that is the really cool thing about podcasts and on even being an entrepreneur is you can affect millions of people. I look at what people like you and Jesse are doing and you're changing one person's life. If you change one person's life, if your podcast has 10 listeners and one of them goes out and starts something cool, or you're showing your kid, or he's telling his kid, it's incredible the impact that these things can have.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that when you imagine, like, I have podcast students who are like, I only have 100 downloads per episode. And I'm like, okay, well, it takes time to get to the thousands, but what if you had 100 people in a room with you right now, you know, minus the pandemic situation, if there were 100 people in a room with you right now and they were there to listen to you, would that make you nervous? And they're like, yeah, well, that's exactly what's happening when you're on a podcast. Because when you're on a podcast, although you are speaking to multiple people at a time, to them, it's essentially a one-on-one conversation. You can build an incredibly deep relationship with people. And I love what you said about that. And whenever I have people come to me who want to start a business, I often ask, okay, well, what does a successful business look like to you? And they're like, oh, millions of sales. I want to create the next fidget spinner. I want to create the next Uber or eBay or something. And I'm like, okay, I mean, that's cool. But what do you really want to do? Where do you imagine your life 5 years from now? How much do you actually need to make in order for you to live that life that you want to live? And it's funny because people don't know how to answer that. And it's interesting because we get so swept up in the, I don't know, fanfare of entrepreneurship and how cool it is right now. And you hear all these stories about people becoming millionaires overnight, which it never happens overnight. But I think that there's a whole number of people who just don't share the fact that they have a business that supports their family, that they can run from home with flexibility, that maybe doesn't make millions, but it makes them that $60,000-$80,000 a year that they once had before, but in a crushing 9-to-5 job. And now they have more flexibility and that's awesome. And so I always try to reverse engineer what that number is. And also I try to paint the picture of, and I've written about this in my book, Superfans, and it's inspired by a man named Kevin Kelly and his story, 1,000 True Fans, where if you do the math here, if you have 1,000 true fans, 1,000 super fans, people who love your art, your work, your creative, who support you, you know, just 1,000 super fans, that's not very much when we all want millions of subscribers, right? But just 1,000. If you multiply 1,000 super fans by $100 a year, which is like less than $10 a month. Superfans for things pay often way, way more. But that's on the low end. $100 a year times 1,000 people. There's your six-figure business right there, right? So you don't need a blockbuster hit. You can niche down. And I often say the riches are in the niches. When you niche down with, or niche down, if you will, but that doesn't rhyme as well. If you get honed in like that, there's less competition. You can speak to that audience much better using the same exact language. They're going to find you as the go-to resource and you're going to be able to help them. And you can stay narrow, 1 inch wide, 1 mile deep with them. And then maybe you go deeper with them, 1 inch wide, 2 miles deep. You offer more and you can just completely serve that audience and not worry about as much competition and live an amazingly successful life where you feel fulfilled because you're supporting not just your family, but also other people out there too.
And what would you say? So I've read the Kevin Kelly, is that right? The 1,000 true fans, I heard that from Ferriss, and that's incredible. But what would you say to the people that say, well, 1,000 seems ridiculous, 100 seems ridiculous? And it seems like you don't see when Pat Flynn had 10 people subscribing to his email list. Like, even to get to 1,000, I think there is some, it's intimidating to get to that point. So, and I think I imagine a lot of your students might throw in the towel when they're not getting these listens. What would you say to people in the very beginning of, okay, so don't even shoot for 1,000. Don't worry about how many likes or downloads your thing gets, because I think those are the kind of things that we see online a lot that really cause people to throw in the towel and maybe just say, oh, I'm not cut out for this. But in the reality, you have to grind through that time. And for me, I know I've had to change my mentality because I was never on social media before, and it was intimidating to spend all this time creating this video or this post and get 2 likes. And I guess what I found is the act of creating, the consistency of being there, and then that one message you got from somebody that said, oh, that's really cool, I'm going through that with my kid too. And that like really did, it like touched me, because I was like, somebody out there is listening. It doesn't matter if 1,000 people are listening. If you can change one person's life, I think that's what is better for you to focus on than trying to reach these numbers, even these only 1,000 true fans. I think that holds a lot of people back.
Yeah, I mean, when I teach people how to start a business, I often say, like, get one person first, one client. Don't build a website. Don't get the social media handles. Just find a person who needs help, who you think you can help, and help them, right? And if you can do that, it's going to, number one, allow you to see what it's like to go and find this person and speak to them in a way where they're going to be receptive to accepting your help. Number two, it's going to teach you where these people exist. Number three, it's going to teach you whether or not you even like to do this. So you can almost micro test this and validate it first before you go wide with it. Number four, if you help this person, number four, you'll learn what it's like to help this person and discover exactly what their objections are, the hard things, and all the things that they might need, so that when you go big with this, you'll better able to understand how to help more people. Number five, you'll have an amazing testimonial already before you even start your website. And number six, and most importantly, you're going to unlock that confidence in your head that this is something, whatever it is that you're choosing to offer, is indeed helpful. And that's a big struggle for people. It's like, oh, I'm not expert enough, or I'm not good enough. You are. You just have to put yourself out there. And whether you think you can or you can't, you're right. Right? That's a Henry Ford quote. And on 1,000 true fans, like, yes, 1,000 sounds a lot, especially to people starting out. That's one fan a day for less than 3 years. If you paint, can you make one fan, can you help one person a day, make them feel a little bit more special? If you've connected with them on Instagram, then you likely have hundreds of people on Instagram who you follow, but are you stepping up to make them feel special, make them feel heard, make them feel like they belong? Most likely no. And this is, again, why I wrote my book Superfans, because these opportunities are there. It doesn't take anything to purchase other than just some time to make people feel like they're being heard, that there's somebody out there that cares for them. That's how you become a person who people can become a fan of, right? So less than one fan a day for less than 3 years, or one fan a day for less than 3 years. I mean, how long have you been working 9 to 5 and not getting $100,000 maybe? I don't know. It depends for different people, but it really paints that picture of this isn't that hard. It just takes work. It's not easy, but it's actually quite simple.
Yeah. And I think that fear, that imposter syndrome, that fear of failing. I mean, for me personally, when I see a misspelling in an email or a video with the oops, I screwed it up, to me, I like that person. I can relate to that person more because it's authentic. My sister and I run a business, kickstartreading.com. We teach kids how to read, and we actually use a Teachable and ConvertKit, our two awesome go-to tech stack, if you will, of our 4 pieces of technology we use. But she gets really nervous when there's a triple check this email and everything. And we are teaching reading, so in her defense, it is important. Yeah. But like when it sends out and then we have to send a oops, sorry, I'm like, you just showed that person that you're human, that you're so I think that's important to be willing to screw up publicly, which is, we're wired for that to be a terrifying thing. I think we have to kind of get over that and either think that in today's world, especially, nobody's really paying attention. Nobody really cares. If anything, if they do catch it and they go tell you, they're paying attention to you now. So I think that's a mindset that's taken me a long time to adopt. And now I'm embracing it.
I like the spin on that. I think that in your particular case with the reading, I mean, it can be like, hey, you know what? We all make mistakes. You're going to make mistakes reading. We're going to make mistakes writing emails, but we can still continue to better ourselves moving forward. I love that positioning for sure. And I used to come home from school when I was in middle school, high school, with like a 97% on my math test. And I'd come home and my dad would be like, hey, so what happened to the other 3%? And we'd spend the next 2.5 hours working on those problems that I got wrong. So I too was conditioned to believe that I had to be perfect, that almost perfect was not good enough. And after getting laid off and discovering this world of entrepreneurship, and literally living with mistakes all day long, you eventually realize that, hey, this is actually a part of the process. You have to fail. In fact, failing faster is the strategy so that you can get to those points of learning and you can adjust and pivot and learn from those mistakes as you move forward. As long as you're falling forward, you're still making progress. So, you know, of course, don't try to fail. And also you can get support along the way to keep you moving, but failure is an option, as the Mythbusters say, and it's important.
Yeah. And is that, so let's get on to your kids who are becoming entrepreneurs, it sounds like. Is that something that you're articulating to them? Are they learning on their own? Are they nervous? Oh, I can't put out this podcast. What's your son's podcast? All Your Beeswax, is that right?
Yeah, All of Your Beeswax. My son and I launched that podcast together a couple of years ago. We actually launched it live on stage in front of 2,000 people in Philadelphia at Podcast Movement. And he was like the surprise guest. And he was calm, cool, and collective on stage. And I'm just so thankful that I have the opportunity to give him that opportunity to get in those situations, because although I would love for my kids to be entrepreneurs eventually, if that's not what they want to do, I don't want to force them into that. I just want them to learn the principles of entrepreneurship, those skills, those soft skills that are going to be so important for not just us, but for our kids moving forward, because automation and robots and all that stuff, I mean, we don't have to go deep into that, but a lot of jobs are being taken now that are things that, you know, we often imagine people doing, not anymore. But there are some things that just robots are not going to be able to do. And that's forming relationships and soft skills and, you know, these kinds of things that I'm teaching my kids. So for example, you know, the getting on stages and sharing ideas with people, not being afraid to share those ideas, even though there's a massive amount of people there, that's a huge skill to learn. To learn that at an early age would be awesome. And I unfortunately was almost kind of forced into that in 2011 when I was asked by a friend to speak on stage. I was going to avoid the stage forever because it was just something I was deathly afraid of doing. And it's the way that I've been able to make the biggest impact on people now. And I realize that now, but I didn't have that training or even that option moving forward when I was a kid. In addition to presentation skills, it's collaboration skills. How can you work with other people who perhaps don't have the same ideas or the same goals and still work together? How do you collaborate with people? That's an important skill. How do you be creative in times? How do you problem solve when there isn't a solution available? How might you learn from your failures and learn from your mistakes? How might you pitch something and sell something, whether it's a product or an idea to your boss or to an employee of yours? It doesn't really matter. These soft skills are what me and my wife are trying to really instill into our kids. And then this idea that they have the ability to, even at this young age, to make an impact. And so we're getting them highly involved in a lot of our charitable work that we do. We offer them a commission every single week if they do all their chores. They have checklists that they have to go off, and based on the number of checks on the checklist, they get paid $1 for each of that, but they get that dollar amount and they know that they have to offer any amount into the jar every single week. This is a very Dave Ramsey sort of, you know, situation. If any of you follow Dave Ramsey's style before, very similar. Here's the donation jar. Take some of your own commission. We don't say, oh, we're just going to keep it. We literally hand the money over so they can put it in the jar with their own hands to know that it's good to give. It is good to serve others who are in need. And this is how we get ahead. This is how I've gotten ahead, serving those who are in need. I just find them online and then I serve them with businesses and different ideas that haven't been made yet. And so this training that we're offering them is great. This idea of one thing, another thing that we do is we have a complaint jar. If they ever come across a problem or something and they don't start thinking about the problem solving, they just complain. If they complain too much, we take a quarter out of their commission jar and then we put it in the complaint jar, right? But if we notice that they're trying to figure out how to solve the problem, and yes, frustration is okay. And in fact, that's important, but just complaining and affecting other people around you because of that is not. So when we see that they're demonstrating proper problem solving etiquette, if you will, even if they don't find a solution, at least wrapping their head around, okay, well, here's the issue. What can we do about it? Well, then we take the quarter out of the complaint jar and put it back into their own jar. So these little things are important. When April and I teach our kids things, we don't tell them what to do. This is what our parents told us. And as a result, we resented a lot of this or just didn't even want to listen. We coach our kids. There's a book called The Coaching Habit by Michael Bungay Stanier, who I would absolutely recommend this book. By far, one of the most impactful books I've ever read, not just for business and how I coach my students, but how me and April coach our kids. Because instead of telling them what to do, we ask loads of questions. You know how kids are often the ones who ask questions a lot? No, we flipped it around. Yeah. We ask them a whole bunch of questions. And guess what? They're receptive. They think, and it makes them explore. And what's cool is we can manage these questions in a way that will eventually, because, you know, we have ideas on what we think would be best for our kids in many cases. And we don't just want to tell them to do that. We want them to discover that on their own. So kind of like Inception, we ask the right questions so they will come up with the answers on their own. And of course, if the kids are the ones to make the green smoothie, they're going to be more likely to drink it, right? Because they got in their hands involved and it kind of came from them. So the green smoothie being an analogy, but sometimes literally a green smoothie as well. But anyway, sorry, I'm just kind of brain dumping a lot of stuff.
Yeah, no, I want to be taking notes. Even your, I'm sure a lot of parents have, like us, have made efforts at the chore jar, the allowance checklist, and it goes out the window. And 2 weeks later, they're just begging for their Lego set. And I'm like, I don't even remember what our setup is supposed to be. So I like that. Are you guys actually using, like, that's the other thing too, are you using real quarters and cash? Because in today's world, it is so, you know, credit card swiping everything. But in this, at the same respect, you kind of need them to see it and feel it, or else it's like, oh, your $5 is in space somewhere. So it's an interesting thing. Yeah.
Did you play poker online?
I did some, yes, online and live, right?
Did you ever feel that because that money was online, it just like you it didn't even feel like money anymore? It was just like points.
Absolutely.
Right. That my roommate in college went and lived in Vegas for a while too. His name is Dylan Wilkerson, and he told me that he started to feel that money was just points now, that he was earning and losing and earning, like it didn't have the same meaning anymore because it was just like all online. So you're right. It's very important that we have like physical dollars, and literally we have to go into the bank every other week just for the allowance, because everything else we do is transactional online. So I think that's important to happen. And trying to, again, set the tone that, you know, money isn't just something that appears out of nowhere. And, you know, we're fortunate to have more money than we ever thought we would, but we don't want that to take away from how the kids feel about money. You know, we don't have a housekeeper. We do everything ourselves. We clean our own dishes. We do our own laundry. Like, everything is done here so that they'll always have those skills. And whether they choose to invest in somebody to help them with those things later, that's fine. But we're choosing to just kind of do everything ourselves so they can never say or never get into the position of, oh, somebody else has to do that for me. Mm-hmm. They could do it on their own if they want, because they've learned how.
Yeah. I am going on Monday to the bank, and I'm going to just get $20 worth of quarters and nickels and dimes, because it is true. Like, they need to see it. They need to feel it. They need to, I mean, my kids too, even the stuff with the punishments and the rewards, like the feedback loop sometimes needs to be so tight and so short that even extending it, that if you do this for 2 weeks, you can get this. Some 2 weeks to them, you know, our attention spans keep shrinking too. So all these like little lessons that I'm sure we were imparted on by our parents, but it does seem a little different, a little more challenging today to, sure, to impart this wisdom to them.
Quarters is a good idea, like actual coins, because when you put them in the jar, they make some good noise.
Hey, talk about Vegas. That's a slot machine. That's how Vegas was built, by that sound of ding, 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 ding.
Right. You need flashing lights now too. Like,
you might see a casino set up here, a chore casino set up here in a couple of weeks. And the other thing too, is I imagine, you know, a lot of people say, oh, Pat's got it all figured out. I'm sure 3 years ago, it was a total circus too. Like, this is probably years of iterating and everything and failing, just like being an entrepreneur on how to parent.
Well, the challenge is, and I remember this even when our firstborn, Kaoni, was a baby, it was like, as soon as you think you have everything figured out, something changes. Their tooth comes in, or they, you know, go through a growth spurt, and like everything that you thought was working just gets out of whack. Right. And so, yeah, it's always a circus. I'm just going to be honest, but we're doing our best to, number one, manage expectations, and number two, just be able to adapt. Adaptability is the key to parenting. And it's also the key to entrepreneurship as well. And when it comes to the business, I mean, what got me here is not going to get me there. I have to understand that if I just continue to do the same things I was, I'm either going to be burnt out, or I'm going to get not as great results, or things are going to diminish. And I have to continue to innovate and to stay on top of things. But again, that doesn't mean I have to be always doing everything. I can either hand off things or take a break from something or set up systems so that things are easier. That's kind of how I stay sane during this process and still innovate and try to stay on top of things for everybody.
Yeah. And one thing I really think is awesome is how you're really are modeling this firsthand for your kids. And now it sounds like between the podcast, and I imagine they have some other online ventures going, a YouTube channel. What are they doing now? Selling products? I heard a podcast with you where you were talking to my wife quit her job. I forgot what his name was, but it was really interesting to hear.
Yeah, Steve and his daughter, they sell t-shirts, and my son got into a pin business because at the school that they're at, they have every year the second and third graders actually from start to finish, beginning of the year to the end. They come up with a product idea. They learn about marketing. They learn about design. They have a logo designer come in and they do logos together. I come in to talk about marketing every once in a while. And at the end of the year, it culminates with them selling their stuff, which are more kind of Etsy type stuff, not services or digital things, but physical things, at a fair. And the entire community comes together and buys things, and they make money, and then they donate the money, which is pretty cool too. So it's just a really cool program, and it's cool to see the kids get involved and get excited about that, to see that they can create something on their own is huge, right? It's huge. I was so impressed with in preschool, they had a curriculum for the day, but then it was really hot and they were actually eating outside and there was no shade because the school was sort of brand new. So the teacher was like, okay, we had plans for the afternoon, but we're actually going to go back inside after lunch and we're going to not do what we said we were going to do because there's a problem here. The problem is we have to eat outside because if we eat inside, there's going to be ants and we don't want ants inside. So here's the constraint. We have to eat outside, but it's too hot. Preschool kids, what do you think we should do? Like having these kids come up with the solutions, right? All the ideas in post-it notes, this is literally how I create products too. And to see this in pre-K was really cool. And of course we're getting updates because apparently that's a thing now with apps like Remind. Teachers can take pictures and you can join like your teacher's group and see almost like Instagram what's happening in your class in real time. So we saw this happening, which was really cool. And post-it notes of just like all the good ideas, the terrible ideas, all on the things. And then they kind of pruned them down and they ended up on one idea, which was to build like these sunshades out of pipe. So the teacher emailed all the parents and said, hey, if you have blankets to donate as well as piping, like PVC pipes that are clean, like send them over next day in school. And then the entire next day, all the kids getting involved with piping and putting these things together, you know, and putting the blankets over them. And then by lunchtime, they were all having lunch in the shade from an idea that they had based on a problem that happened the day before. And it was just like so mind-blowing. It's like, wow, these kids came up with it. The teacher, they're just guides, right? And it was really showing them that, hey, all you guys working together, like everything I talked about that I would want to happen then, which is really cool. And so, you know, these kids are smart, they're powerful, they're incredible. They just don't often have the opportunities to demonstrate that or don't even know it's possible, which is why in my case, I'm always trying to show the kids everything I'm doing so they could see everything. I mean, even literally right before this call, they were about to go back to their Zoom calls for school. And I was like, hey, I'm about to do this interview with a guy named Rob. And he's cool because he interviews people about parenting. And he helps other parents and their kids have better relationships. And they're like, oh, that's really cool. Have a good interview, Dad. And that's it. But now they know why I'm here. Now work is meaning to it. Now it's not, oh, Daddy's going to work and that means he's gone. Now they know. And actually they feel good about that, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, that is incredible. And I think it goes against our instinct to do everything for our kids, to protect them, to fix stuff. I mean, even something as simple as, Dad, can you tie my shoe? After a while of him struggling with it, I'm like, let's go already. We need to get out of the house and I'll do it. So it is like it's almost like a repetition that you need to say, nope, you need to figure it out. And it takes patience. And sometimes it's going to slow us down. And I was reading something that they say a lot of the like helicopter parenting that you see a lot of, and a lot of that is really not, it's just about the parent's own anxiety. So when we are struggling with it, and I struggle with some of this stuff too, or I'm overprotecting my kids and saying, get off the chair that you're going to fall down. It's really my anxiety that I'm trying to quell. So a lot of these things, I think we learn as when you have kids, you don't realize that, oh, I have no idea how to be a parent, right? It's like, I feel like a little better I feel some empathy for my parents thinking that they knew it all. So.
Exactly. You know, the first baby I ever held was my son after he was born. I was so scared of kids before and it was a scary time for sure. But I'm not the perfect parent. I'm still learning every day. I make absolute mistakes. Like I don't want this to feel like I know everything. I don't. I'm figuring it out as I go, right? And I'm talking to a lot of people, which is why I love and appreciate this and how we're able to share this conversation together, because I'm learning from others too who have already experienced things. With the tying the shoes thing, I think I love that you mentioned that, because we did that with our kids too. It's like, go tie your shoe. I don't know how. Okay, well, how might you figure out? We often say questions like that. How might you be able to figure that out? I could find a video. Okay, how might you find a video? I could go to YouTube. Can I go on YouTube right now? Go ahead. We got some time. And, you know, they figure it out and they learn that there's resources out there that could teach them, right? So it's funny because now there's things that happen and my kids will come back and they'll be like, hey, we fixed this. And I was like, I didn't even know it broke. And I'm like, how did you fix it? They're like, oh, we just watched the YouTube video. I'm like, good job. Like you found a resource to help you. Like, that's awesome. And then, you know, what was funny with the tying the shoe things is like our kids started teaching other kids at their school how to tie their shoes too, because they were one of the first ones to learn, because they were almost kind of thrown in the deep end, but, you know, in a safe manner.
Yeah.
There was even one time where they're like, hey, can we tie our shoe? And we really had to go. And I was just like, oh, I guess our shoe's not going to be tied. And of course they were tripping over themselves. They were falling and we look like terrible parents, but we also know that they're probably going to learn how to tie their shoe, so that never happens again, because now they know what it's like not to tie their shoe.
Yeah.
And it seems kind of bad sometimes when I think about it, but I'm grateful that it teaches them in that way.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the things that I think you're doing that are good as parents are actually like the results of it look terrible and painful, and the parents doing everything for the kids. Again, that's really not helping your kids. That's probably setting them up for more failure. It's just in the short term, you've got to swallow some frustration. You're going to look like a fool a lot of times, but hey, that's parenting, right?
Parenting.
Yes. Yeah. So you mentioned your dad earlier. Now that you're a parent, and I'm sure you're like me in that we had no idea until you actually hold a kid, your kid, you have no idea what it's like to be a parent. Even then, it takes a couple of years for me. Right. Is there one thing that you learned from your parents that you're applying now as a dad?
My mom and dad showed up for as many band concerts, sporting events as possible. And, you know, I didn't realize how awesome that was, because they didn't have to do that. And a lot of other parents drop off their kids, even at practices, my parents would show up and be there. And it's like, oh, you didn't have to do that. And it made me appreciate a lot of those kinds of moments even more, for sure. So it's been really important for me. And I'm, again, very grateful that I have a flexible schedule, so that in case the kids have a showcase at their school or some sporting event or a piano recital or something, like, I can always make sure that I can be there for them, because I want to do that like my parents did for me. That meant a lot, for sure.
Yeah. And that's something that we completely take for granted as kids. And now as parents, taking my kid to baseball and to this, I'm like, man, I feel like I'm an Uber driver half the time. So it really makes you, I've called my parents and be like, oh, I appreciate you for doing this. I didn't realize it for 43 years, but now I can see it wasn't as easy. And they're, you know, that's the perks of being a grandparent. I think they can just sit there and smirk and laugh and say, oh, not so easy, is it, Pat?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So Pat, on the Dad the Best I Can podcast, we like to do a dad tip. Do you have one tip for other dads out there?
Yeah, I have a tip, and it relates to school. And when the kids come home from school, typically we ask questions like, so how is school today, right? Oh, it's fine. And I wanted more in-depth answers. So I don't know who it was that taught me this, but I'm so grateful and I'm happy to pass it on to any of you who are listening. But when the kids come home from school, my wife and I ask them, what can you teach me today? Not even what did you learn today, but phrasing it in a way where it empowers the kid to feel like they actually can share something with us. It does two things. One, like I said, it empowers them to teach, and they get excited when you ask them to teach you something, right? And number two, it also shows that we're on the same level as them in many cases, that we're not the people who know everything, and that we can continue to have this back and forth, let's learn from each other sort of relationship. So what can you teach me today? Use it. I promise it's going to get you some really good answers.
Oh, I'm going to use it, especially with this virtual school, because now they're just walking into the other room. So I need to have a good question. That's good. All right. We're going to mix it up here with a little rapid fire questions. Are you ready? I got a little sound effect for you. Hold on here, Pat.
Nice. I got one too.
Oh, wow. This is fun. This fun of a podcast. I feel like Howard Stern and Fred here playing with my sound effects.
Yeah, or maybe like Jim Cramer or something.
Yes. All right, Pat Flynn, what was your first car?
My first car was a 1996 Toyota Tacoma, extended cab, dark green.
What was your first job?
My first job was for a company called Picnic People, where on the weekends, I was still in high school, but on the weekends, I would be brought to a park somewhere, and essentially a company would have a giant corporation picnic. And our team was there to cater to the picnic and serve drinks, food, all that stuff. Literally the shortest shorts I've ever seen for a uniform. Bright green shorts, like shorter than running shorts. It was so embarrassing, especially when I like saw my friends and their family at these events. Not cool. And then a bright yellow shirt with a sun holding a soda in one hand and a hot dog in another. That was my first job.
You've come a long way, Pat.
Thank you.
What is your favorite meal to eat for dinner?
My favorite meal, if I had a choice, and it would be buffalo wings, medium, extra wet, buffalo wings with ranch dressing.
What is your kid's favorite meal to eat for dinner?
My daughter, absolutely a mac and cheese fiend. She will literally eat that every day if we let her. And my son, he is a burger boy. He absolutely devours burgers of all kinds.
All right, I know you're a movie buff. What is your favorite dramatic movie of all time?
My favorite dramatic movie? I would say probably Inception, if you might call that a drama. I mean, many people know my favorite movie, which is Back to the Future. I don't know if that's necessarily a drama. I think that's more of a comedy, really. But Inception.
I was going to say, what is your favorite comedy? Back to the Future, I'll give you it's a dramedy, but it's great. What were you showing? You got a copy of the first draft of the screenplay, is that right?
I do, and it's very different. Somebody sent it to me because they knew I was a big fan, which is pretty cool.
What is your favorite live concert you've ever seen?
Ed Sheeran was pretty dope. Ed Sheeran, single man band with the looper and his guitar, just crushed. It was so incredible. And I have to say, I was actually really impressed. I'm not a big Backstreet Boys fan. My wife is the big Backstreet Boys fan. I'm more of an NSYNC fan. But I went to a NKOTBSB concert, which is New Kids on the Block Backstreet Boys concert in Vegas. And man, it was actually, I had a really good time. It was really fun. And it was cool to see April smile and relive her childhood again.
Yeah, that's a 90s feel for sure. If you were a Major League Baseball player, what would be your walkout song?
My walkout song used to be I Wish. Like, I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I was a baller. And it was like all this self-deprecating stuff. But I think it would be right now, probably something like Eye of the Tiger, some traditional like that I usually listen to when I work out to just kind of pump me up. I'd be a pitcher though. I would want to pitch. Nolan Ryan was my favorite player. So, you know, my walkout song probably wouldn't have people expect that I would hit like a home run or anything.
Yeah, we had a guest on here who was a Major League Baseball player, and he said some games when his family wasn't there, he would be Britney Spears, Hit Me Baby One More Time, just to embarrass himself.
So funny.
And so you have several podcasts. What is your favorite podcast to listen to right now?
Right now, I'm a big fan of Sean Stevenson, Model Health Show. He just has the best way to share some really good health and nutrition-related information in a way that's really relatable and also teaches a lot of the science behind it. And it's just fun. He has a really cool personality.
All right. Great answers, Pat. Before we go, I've been watching your YouTube channel, which is incredible. I had no idea. It's really, you've stepped up your game a lot there. But I caught a video that was really interesting and something I need to work on. And I imagine a lot of people listening. We're doing all of these video calls now, whether it's Zoom for work or podcasts like this. And you gave some really helpful tips. Could you give maybe two or three of the tips that other people can use when they're doing a call, whether it's for work or something like this?
For sure. So number one, you don't want to have light behind you. If your window is open behind you, you're going to look like a silhouette. You want the light facing you. And the best kind of light that you can get is, in fact, natural light. So if you can face a window, have your camera or computer webcam face you, then you're going to have this nice sort of blended wash over your face and you're going to look really good in the background and it's darker. And that's the kind of what you want. You'll pop out a little bit more. Number two, make sure that your camera lens is at eye level, or else if it's too high, you're going to look small and tiny. If it's too low, you're going to look like you're standing over everybody, which doesn't leave a good impression. Number three, make sure that you're always looking at the lens of the camera. If you need to put a little post-it note arrow and point to the lens, do that, because oftentimes we are looking down at the monitor or our computer when really it's the eye that you want to look at, which is the lens. And so I've sort of trained myself to look at the lens of the camera, whether it's your phone or a webcam. And then finally, definitely make use of that mute button when you're not speaking. That way, in case something happens or you have a little toot or something, I don't know.
Yeah, the toot button, we call it here, right?
Exactly. So the mute button can be your best friend.
So are you looking at me right now, or are you looking above it where the camera is? That's what
I'm trying to figure out. I'm not looking at you. You're down. If I were to look at you, this is what it would be looking like.
Oh, wow. I must look terrible then on your angle. I did borrow your tip, though. I put a little post-it note right in the middle of the screen, so I'm trying to improve. And your other tip that I used is open mouth smile, so you don't have the resting bored face for yes. an hour on a call, which I know I'm guilty of, and it really does help. It's like, oh, you're doing it again. You gotta fake it a little.
You kind of have to over-exaggerate for the video, yeah, for sure, in that way. If you're just kind of listening to the other person speak, it goes a long way. So
yeah. And the standing up tip. I'm standing up right now, too. So look at all these things I've learned from you just preparing for this.
I'm not even standing up. I've been standing up all day, so I wanted to sit for this.
And before we go, you're doing a really cool thing for the teachers out there. Can you share how you're helping teachers during this crazy school time?
For sure. So every month on my morning show, The Income Stream, which is a daily show on YouTube, today was a day 177 in a row. Every month we support a different charity or organization. This month we are actually focusing on just teachers in general. And what I'm doing is on Twitter, I'm figuring out who is a teacher who's actually paying out of their own pocket. And whatever supplies they need, I'm going to buy it for them. And I've just been doing that sort of one or two teachers a day. Already spent like $4,000 for teachers so far. And it's just a shame that teachers who are already underpaid and underappreciated have to go out of their pocket to pay even more to support the kids that we send to the schools. So I'm just kind of stepping up to support. And even though I won't be able to support everybody, at least it's making people aware, at least even more thankful when they see this done publicly. So that's who we're supporting this month. And any super chats that come in on the YouTube or donations or membership fees or whatever, that they get pushed over to these teachers that I find.
Yeah, I mean, as hard as this is for the kids, as hard as it is for the parents right now, I leave the day thinking, God, these teachers are saints. I don't know how they're doing it. They're on a Zoom call with how many kids and parents and sitting in a classroom by themselves. So utmost respect for them out there. And that's a really cool thing you're doing, just bringing awareness that we can help them too.
Thank you.
All right, Pat, I appreciate you being on Dad's Best I Can podcast here on BYLR Radio. Where can people learn more about what you're doing?
You can find me at smartpassiveincome.com or at Pat Flynn on most social media channels and also on YouTube at Pat Flynn.
Your YouTube, incredible, but your Instagram, you do these little reels, which I'm too old to figure out, I think, but they're like 10 seconds. They're hilarious and they're spot on. So keep doing those. Those are great.
Thank you. I'm having a lot of fun exploring that platform for sure.
All right, Pat, I appreciate you.